This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Let's talk about the national debt. It's been with us for as long as the United States has been a nation, and technically even before that. The founding fathers borrowed to finance the revolution. And the U.S. has carried an ever-growing debt burden under every single presidential administration since. The lone exception being Andrew Jackson, who announced the complete payoff of the U.S. national debt in 1835. And that lasted exactly 1 year before lawmakers once again had to borrow on the full faith and credit of the United States to beat back a depression. So debt is woven into the nation's story. But Andrew Jackson aside, the thread of the powerful political fear of the modern national debt traces back about 40 years.
For decades, we have piled deficit upon deficit, mortgaging our future and our children's future for the temporary convenience of the present. To continue this long trend is to guarantee tremendous social, cultural, political, and economic upheavals.
President Ronald Reagan in his 1981 inaugural address. Before Reagan took office, the federal debt was $907 billion. But he was a deficit spender. So by 1989, the federal debt rose to $2.8 trillion. And it kept rising.
We have an obligation, you and I, to leave our children a legacy of opportunity, not a legacy of debt.
President Bill Clinton at the 1996 Democratic National Convention when the national debt topped $5.2 trillion. In 2001, President George W. Bush asked Congress,
I hope you will join me to pay down $2 trillion in debt during the next 10 years.
But 10 years and two wars later, the national debt had ballooned to $14.7 trillion, and still it rose to stabilize the country after the 2008 financial crisis. Later, in the Obama administration, then-House Speaker Republican Paul Ryan said in 2011,
a few years ago, reducing spending was important. Today, it's imperative. Here's why. We face a crushing burden of debt. The debt will soon eclipse our entire economy and grow to catastrophic levels in the years ahead.
The national debt rose under the Trump administration, and now with the Biden administration, the national debt is making headlines yet again. Here's West Virginia Democrat Senator Joe Manchin's reaction to the $3.5 trillion budget plan Senate Democrats passed earlier this month.
I do not believe that $3.5 trillion is where we should be going based on what we have going on with inflation, what we have going on with the national debt, the indications we have, and the unknown of the COVID-19 or the Delta variants.
Biden and other Democrats would argue that the debt increase pales in comparison to the gains the nation could make with massive investments in healthcare, education, infrastructure, and preparing for climate change. So here's what we're wondering. The U.S. national debt is huge, more than $28 trillion, according to the Congressional Budget Office. That is larger than the nation's entire GDP. But is fear of that debt stopping government from solving big, complex problems, from investing in the country in a way that could strengthen and grow the nation? That's what we're going to explore today. And with us to do that is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Hello there, Jack.
Hello, Meghna.
And also with us today is Maya McGinnis, president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, a nonpartisan nonprofit organization that's committed to educating the public on issues with significant fiscal policy impact. Maya McGinnis, welcome to you.
Thank you.
You know, in this hour, we also want to really take advantage of the opportunity to help educate folks on what they want to know about the national debt. So hop on Twitter and Facebook, everyone, and send us your questions about the national debt. We're at On Point Radio. And in fact, Maya, if you don't mind, I'd like to start with a question that we received from a listener. Meg Becker wants to know, explain the difference between the national debt and the national deficit.
Well, that's a perfect place to start. And let me just, before I jump into the numbers, say they are all really, really big and it's hard to grasp them. So I'll do my best to bring them down onto the individual level. But on that basic question, the deficit is how much we borrow every year, how much more we are spending than we are taking in taxes. And the past couple of years, it's been massive, $3 trillion basically because of the COVID emergency. But going forward, those deficits will be about $1 trillion, which is also quite massive. Now, if you add all those deficits together, you basically, that's how you come to our total national debt. And so that's the accumulation of all these years of borrowing and raising less than we are spending. And the debt, as you said, the total debt that we have, $28 trillion. And there's another important number, which is the debt held by the public, which is $22 trillion. That takes out how much we actually owe to ourselves in programs like Social Security.
Okay, so can you explain the difference then between the debt held by the public versus debt held by, I think the other term is the government, right?
Yeah, total debt and debt held by the public. The debt held by the public is debt that we issued out by selling treasuries, bills, bonds, and notes. That's how we finance our big deficits every year. And then we also borrow money from the Social Security trust funds, which for many years had surpluses. So we now have to repay that money back. So it's money we owe to ourselves, but it still means that when we're repaying what we owe to Social Security and some other small trust funds, we have to figure out how to raise those dollars, just like when we're repaying any other debt. What's also important is how much the debt is as a share of the economy. And just to give a little context, kind of traditionally, historically, our debt as a share of GDP or the full economy has been below 40%. In the past decade, it's gotten much, much higher because we've had not one, but two huge crises, the Great Recession, 2008, 2009, and the COVID emergency. We've borrowed so much then. So our debt is now over 100% of GDP. And that this is the highest it's ever been, other than right after World War II, when we had just completed fighting a world war. So just in terms of how much space it takes, it's very high, almost the highest it's ever been, and it's projected to keep growing.
Okay, so Jack, let me turn to you there. These are quite astonishingly large numbers that Maya's sharing with us. I mean, your take on the size, the current size of the debt.
Well, I am a child of the post-war era when, as Maya says, the 1946, the debt was 100% of GDP, more. And nothing was done by way of sacrificing to pay off that debt except economic growth, except the expansion of the economy. And, of course, what was the result? The result was a unprecedented boom that some have called the American high that lasted into the 1970s. That high was buoyed by all that debt not being repaid. So my question to Maya is, can you point to something that I'm missing in that? I'm saying that that huge debt was, far from being an impediment to the economy, was a kind of fuel. There were no sacrifices made that I'm aware of to pay it off. Why is that not also true of the Biden debt?
Sure, I can respond to that. So unfortunately, I wish that it were true. I wish that the more that you didn't pay for things, the better it was for the economy. But when something sounds too good to be true, it usually is. So what happened after World War II, of course, is that after spending all that money, we very, very abruptly brought down our government spending and our big deficits each year shrunk, so that we were running surpluses some year, balanced the budget some year, borrowing modest amounts some year, at the same time that we had that growth. So our fiscal situation, we had fiscal consolidation where we were being more responsible and the economy was growing with the post-war boom. And importantly, the baby boomers, who were all sort of fueling labor force at that time. Now what we have is a debt where it's projected to keep growing every year instead of shrinking. And importantly, we have the aging society. So those very people who are fueling the economy then because of demographics are now moving into retirement. So that is going to contract our economy. So we are dealing with these fiscal challenges and the headwinds of an aging society, much more difficult than it was then. The other thing about deficit spending, and I should be very clear, there's good debt and there's bad debt. When we have emergencies, when we have pandemics, we should be borrowing as much as needed. And one of the important reasons to worry about your fiscal situation is so that you're able to borrow during those emergency times. We can talk more about that. But when you borrow, it means that you can give the economy kind of a sugar high and help it right then. Again, that's really helpful if you're in a recession. But in the longer term, it means that you are borrowing for short-term economic growth, but longer-term lower economic growth. And that's one of the downsides of borrowing, which is it's not sustained growth. How you get sustained growth is more investments, more productivity-enhancing changes. Those are the things that grow your economy every year instead of just in the short term.
Well, so, oh my gosh, there's so much I want to ask you about what you just said. But let me just ask you this. Why is the debt projected to continue on this very rapid growth trajectory? Unlike, as you were saying beforehand, it didn't grow as rapidly.
Yeah, great question. So we have a couple different things. We right now have built-in structural deficits, even when the economy is going well, because we've built a lot of programs that are growing faster than the economy and revenues that are actually also growing faster than the economy, but not keeping up. So we have structural deficits every year. This is mainly fueled by the retirement of the baby boomers and growing healthcare costs. Interest on the debt is also one of the fastest growing areas of the budget right now. And so we've built in these changes. This doesn't even account for if there are further emergencies, which I think anybody can look around the world these days and say it feels like these emergencies are coming. They're bigger and they're quicker. So we should be more prepared for those. That will require more borrowing. And it also doesn't even include the borrowing that's being talked about now for some of these big investment programs that the Biden agenda is looking at. So it's basically, here's the bottom line. Politicians used to be willing to pay for what they thought was important. Now they would much rather borrow, and borrowing they are.
Okay. Well, we are talking about the national debt and asking this big question about whether the very concerns that Maya McGinnis is sharing with us, whether those concerns are also perhaps stopping government from making longer term investments in things that could strengthen the overall economy. So Maya and Jack, stand by. We just have to take a quick break. Jack, I'm going to give you a chance to respond when we come back in just a minute. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are trying to understand why so many people in Washington are afraid of the national debt, the ever-growing national debt, and asking whether or not that fear at this moment in 2021, perhaps is getting in the way of government solving some very big long-term problems in the United States. And to help us with this exploration, I'm joined today by Maya McGinnis, president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. On Point News analyst Jack Beatty is with us as well. And Jack, I wanted to give you a chance to respond to what Maya was talking about her future, why she's concerned about the future growth rate of the national debt.
Well, I can't speak to the future, but let's look at the past. I mentioned the post-war boom, and I said that it was fueled by debt. And Maya said, well, but the government brought its deficits went down. There was an effort to control the – that's true. They didn't pay off the debt. So there was no debt. The horribles are there will be crowding out, that the government – we will be looking for so much money to pay the interest cost, it'll crowd out private borrowing. It will preclude more public spending because the government will be spending so much to finance the debt. That didn't happen after the Second World War. By contrast, look at the Depression. In 1933, the Harvard Economics Department, a young instructor was called on the carpet by the chairman of the department. Why? Because he had taught a section on deficit spending. The conventional wisdom then was you have to balance the budget. And there was this heavily moralized view of government spending as like, you know, husband and wife over the kitchen table, pay your bills, eat your spinach. That hidebound idea of the danger of debt made the Depression so much worse than it had to be, such that in 1939, after nearly a decade of trying to get unemployment down, it was a great achievement that it had reached 14%. And, of course, what ended all that? Government spending. It could have done that all along, except for the shibboleth, the idol of balance the budget, eat your spinach, what Maya is standing for.
Okay,
Maya,
can
go ahead.
Jump in? Shibboleth, mm-hmm. Great word. Okay, let me respond. First point is nobody's actually talking about paying off the debt. That would be very unwise. In fact, the debt serves a really important role in our global economy. It is the backbone of the global economy with its treasuries, the treasury market, right? What people think is important, or what I would argue is important, is that our debt not continue to grow faster than the economy on an unsustainable long-term trajectory. That is where all the projections are right now. Again, I don't even think that we need to balance the budget. That's not the objective here. What the objective is to make sure that you have the capacity in your economy to borrow when there's emergencies so that you can help prop up the economy when you have a huge decline or a huge emergency. And the way that you do that is you don't borrow all the time, no matter what. The problem that we have right now is we borrow during emergencies. That's what we should do. We did a really good job of responding to the pandemic by borrowing very quickly, getting it into the economy very quickly. The problem is we borrow when the economy is strong. In the 3 years under President Trump, before we were hit with COVID, Congress passed $4.7 trillion in borrowing. That led to our debt being much higher than it should be, which means we're in a weakened position going forward. Likewise, we're now talking about a lot of spending, even though the economy is very strong, that instead of being paid for, would actually borrow, and that will make the debt load heavier. And the reason you do worry about it is it actually does slow the growth of the economy. I disagree that you don't see any problems when you borrow. What it does is it gradually chips away at your growing standard of living, meaning we would all have higher salaries today if we hadn't borrowed unnecessarily in the past. Borrow for the things that make sense. Don't borrow just because you don't want the convenience of having to pay for things and you'd rather pass that debt on to your children, which is what we do so often. And the other real risk is looking forward. There are so many vulnerabilities. If interest rates go up, our dependency on foreign countries to borrow, to finance our debt, changes in the role of our currency, all of those we are very vulnerable to because our debt is so high. And it's unwise to leave ourselves with that huge vulnerability instead of paying for things that are important when the economy is strong, which basically we're just unwilling to do for political reasons.
Okay, I want to bring Christian Weller into the conversation now. He's the senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and a professor of public policy and public affairs at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. Professor Weller, welcome to you.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Magno.
Okay, so I want to sort of segue into the big question that we're asking here using a comment from a listener named Matt Wade, who actually, he says, the national debt is the amount of public investment our government has made that the private sector refuses to make. And so Matt says, frankly, the debt is nowhere near high enough. Your thoughts?
Well, I agree with Maya that not all debt and deficits are created equal. We have taken on debt unnecessarily. We have wasted some resources, most recently probably with the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act under President Trump, which showered about $1.9 trillion on the richest Americans and corporations who already sat on $5 trillion of cash without any known benefit from that. I mean, that was truly wasteful money. On the other hand, picking up on a theme that Maya reiterates, is government spending should happen and public spending, public fiscal policy should happen when there are emergencies. The pandemic is not the only emergency. It was sort of an unknown emergency that came out of the blue at us, but that doesn't mean we don't have other emergencies that we need to address. We have a crumbling infrastructure. We have a healthcare and childcare crisis. We have massive widespread income and wealth inequality. We have climate risks emergence. The country is burning and drowning in different parts right now. So we need to address those emergencies right now because they're known. It's not like we can wait for these things to somehow unwind themselves because they've built up over decades. And now is the time to address them. Why is now the time to address them? Because interest rates are really low. All addressing these problems will stabilize economic growth in two ways. One, the first way to doing it is it will boost economic growth, for instance, through infrastructure, rural broadband, better healthcare, better childcare. We increase labor force participation, especially among women, and so on and so forth. That boosts productivity growth. The other part is by addressing these known risks, like climate change and other things, and massive wealth and income inequality, we're reducing the risks to the economy. We're reducing the chance that there will be another massive financial crisis like the Great Recession. And so you're doing two things at the same time with this $3.5 trillion that the Congress is negotiating right now. That is, you're boosting economic growth by increasing productivity growth and by reducing the macroeconomic uncertainty over things that we know are emergencies. So
yeah.
I think the time to invest in these things is right now. And again, it matters what you're taking the money on, what you're taking on the debt. And the estimates, independent estimates, suggest that the gap that is left in terms of what needs to be spent will ultimately be paid for with faster growth and the additional revenue that will come from that faster growth.
So Maya, I'm going to come back to you in just a second, but Professor Weller, I've got to ask you, have you talked to Senator Joe Manchin about this? Because as we played at the beginning of the show today, I mean, he is pointing to the debt as one of the reasons why he's a little uncertain about making those very same investments that you're talking about. Professor Weller, do you hear me? Okay, we're going to try to get him back on the line. So Maya McGinnis, let me turn back to you here. So it seems like Christian Weller was making an argument that I wanted to ask you about, that it's that regarding the $3.5 trillion budget plan that Senate Democrats have proposed or passed, it's not, you know, they don't see it necessarily as just short term spending, but rather immediate investment that will produce a long-term gain in terms of a stronger economy and perhaps a faster growing GDP in the face of known challenges. And so therefore, the very logic that you gave about reasons why it's okay to increase the national debt, they see it applying in this case. Your thoughts?
Sure. Okay. So let me first respond to the caller's question, who said the debt is just a reflection of our public investment, so we don't need to worry about it. If that were true, things would be much better. The problem is so much of our debt is actually borrowed for consumption, not investment. The vast majority of our budget goes for consumption, between probably 80, 85%. Importantly, our federal budget spends $6 per senior on every one it invests in children under 18. So we have a consumption-oriented budget. It would make a lot more sense if we paid for our consumption. We would then have space to think about borrowing more for investments. But right now, we're borrowing $1 trillion primarily for consumption. What I really want to focus on, though, is there is a difference between emergencies and really, really important things. What we're talking about for the Biden administration are some very important priorities that I happen to think are critical parts of our budget that have been underinvested in for not years, but decades. But just because something's important doesn't mean it's good for the economy to ask the future to pay for it instead of financing it today. And I think that's what Senator Joe Manchin is talking about when he says he's worried about the debt. The unsustainable position of our debt is a problem, just like the underinvestment in a lot of different areas of our economy. But what the Congressional Budget Office has found, and they just put out great impartial reports for anybody who wants to read more, but CBO has shown that an infrastructure bill or public investments there that are not paid for would actually have negative effects on the economy over time. Whereas if you pay for them, they have positive effects. So if you're talking about what's best for the economy, it's quite clear that paying for it in smart ways is better for the overall growth of the economy while also pursuing many of these important priorities. But I just want to make that distinction. Something that is important, incredibly important, is not necessarily an emergency in the economic sense where it was unknown to happen and it was crashing the GDP growth, which is when you do want to borrow to prop up the economy, like we just had during the pandemic, like we had during the Great Recession, 2008, 2009.
Okay. But one thing that I don't understand is, so the national economy definitely does not work in the same way as, say, a person's individual economy. So I'm going to advance, before I ask this question, I'm going to say that I understand that there's a difference. However, people are often told to think about the national debt in that way. What I'm wondering is, oftentimes, I don't know, to start a small business, to make improvements to your house. I mean, these are things that people, if they're smart about it and, you know, fiscally prudent, they still are willing to take on debt for something that's important in order, you know, may not be an emergency like pipes exploding in my house, but I want to like just improve it to increase its overall value. And so it's something that I think is not seen as needing to be done in emergencies only. So does that analogy not apply to the nation as a whole?
Like you said, households in the country are quite different. So there's a couple things here. One, I would think it would make a lot more sense for us to think about borrowing for investment if we weren't borrowing so much for consumption, because in the end, our debt is dangerously high in terms of being prepared for future emergencies, not being so dependent on things like low interest rates or China for lending us money. There are a lot of reasons this high debt is a big problem, growing interest payments, which are squeezing out other parts of the budget.
If we let me just jump in there for a second. Because this consumption thing is important. So I'll let you finish, but I take your point on that. Why not just raise revenues? We cut taxes instead of raise them.
Well, I thought we were going to go into that next. I'm really looking forward to the conversation about how to pay for these things, because absolutely, we need to raise revenues. That's exactly what we should be doing. But in terms of your question about households, we're not the same in that when we say we're going to borrow, so we're already borrowing for consumption. And there are lots of things you would want to spread out the cost of borrowing for investments. But keep in mind, when it's a household, you're saying, once my business takes off, I will repay this debt. What we're saying is, when we have put these programs into place, we'll ask younger workers or our kids to pay this debt. And I think one thing that's clear, and this is kind of scarier than the debt, is that the world is ever changing with new threats and dangerous situations where we may have many, many emergencies that we need to be prepared to borrow for. And so saying to our kids, we are leaving you, your inheritance is this huge, massive debt, that is leaving them in a very dangerous position, giving all the future risks. But to your point that you just brought up, let's talk about how to pay for this stuff, because I'm not saying being fiscally responsible is not the same as saying, let's not spend government money. It's saying, let's pay for it instead of asking somebody else to. And it's true that in the past, we were much more willing to say, if something's important, it is worth paying for. So there's lots of options for how to pay for these costs.
Okay. I think I have Christian Weller back. Do I have you there, Christian?
I'm here, yes.
Okay. And Jack, I heard you wanted to get in too, so I'm definitely going to get to both of you here. But Christian, let me just give you a minute to respond to what you heard Maya McGinnis say.
Well, the main point really is we have these risks right now, and they're massive. I mean, the climate risk is really disruptive. We can make the investments right now, and we need to undertake them right now. Should we borrow for them? In part, we should. The interest rates are low. This is the time to borrow to pay for it. That, in part of it, again, independent estimates suggest that whatever gap is left in terms of between the additional spending and the additional revenue proposed right now will ultimately come from faster growth. And I think those estimates underestimate, those projections underestimate how much bang for the buck we're going to get, because they're based on the traditional productivity growth models. We're going to invest in the economy and its infrastructure, rural broadband, and other things. And that will ultimately make people more productive, and that leads to faster growth. What these models, these forecasts do not address is that the elimination or the reduction of known risks like climate risk, making the economy more resilient, an aging society, and therefore drop off in the labor force participation rate without any investments in women's labor force participation rates and other things, that we reduce these risks, and they're underestimated in these projections. So we're probably going to get a much bigger bang for the buck than we think we will. In in terms of how we pay for it, yeah. I mean, I think we're probably, I'm not sure that Maya and I will agree on how we pay for it. But we just passed in 2017 a massive tax cut that we know was incredibly wasteful. So let's take some of it or all of it back because we didn't get much for it. And that will bring in additional revenue. Give yeah. the IRS more money to actually enforce what's on the tax, on the books. That will bring in $500 to $1 trillion a year and will help yeah. us pay for the things we need to invest in.
So Christian Weller and Maya McGinnis, hang on here. Jack, I'm going to give you first swing when we come back from this quick break. We're talking today about the national debt, how to understand it, the size of it now and what it could be in the future, and whether or not the size of the debt is interfering with Washington's desire or ability to solve big and complex problems the country is facing now. We'll have more in just a moment. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Just want to give you a heads up about tomorrow's show. We're going to be hearing from a former U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan and a former high-level defense official. One of them says the American exodus from Afghanistan and its chaotic outcome is having him question President Biden's capacity to lead this country. The other is going to say that President Biden was right, that the United States had to have a hard stop to its forever war. So we want to hear from you. Do you think the U.S. made the right decision? If you served or worked in Afghanistan in any capacity, how has your experience affected your opinion about what you're seeing taking place in that nation now? Call us with your thoughts and stories at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. Especially wanting to hear from people who served or worked in Afghanistan. That's for tomorrow's show. Today we're talking about the national debt, and I'm joined today by Maya McGinnis, Christian Weller, and Jack Beattie. Jack's our On Point news analyst. And Jack, I know you wanted to get in there responding to the beefy conversation we had in the last segment, so go ahead.
Just to make the point, the second Biden soft infrastructure program, increase in corporate taxes, increase in capital gains rates, more taxes on assets at death, a lot of it is paid for. So if the program passes as written, much of it would pay for itself. And that's what Maya seems to want. More importantly, this Biden program is a return to the Harry Hopkins mantra. We shall tax and spend and elect. That was the motto of the New Deal, and politically it worked. Why is it so important that it worked today? Yes, for all the reasons that the professor has said, we need investment in all sorts of things that have run down. We also need, and Biden needs, a rampart of spending against the return of an increasingly authoritarian, anti-democratic Republican Party. The only way he can win re-election, or the Democrats can win re-election, is to build that rampart of spending high, to get the economy flourishing, to have more and more prosperity reach into red states, to try to buy down some of the anti-democratic fever of the Republican Party. A lot is at stake on this Biden program beyond economics.
Christian Weller, do you want to respond to that? Oh, yeah, Maya, I'll let you go in a second, but let's hear from Christian Weller first.
I'm not a political scientist nor a political economist, but I would say the most important, one of the challenges we have in that we learned after the Great Recession is that modest growth alone, that you, if you go too small and you have modest growth, you ultimately end in the current situation with way too much inequality. That leaves families with too little income, too little wealth, and they're ill-prepared for a future emergency, and they're ill-prepared to invest in their own future. It's harder for them to start a business, to grow a business, to buy a house, to send their kids to college. So what we need is not just faster growth. We also need to make sure that that growth is equitably shared, and that is part of the infrastructure investments that President Biden is suggesting. That means child tax credits. That means things like generally more growth, faster growth, higher minimum wages, more ways to join a union, and so on and so forth. We need to do all of these things because prior to the pandemic, we had built up all of these problems. They came in stark relief during the pandemic, but now is the time for us to address them. We do need to make these investments. We can no longer kick these investments in people, in communities, in the economy down the road. That will lead to greater, faster growth and more equitable growth and more sustainable growth over the time. That doesn't mean we shouldn't ultimately pay for them, that we need to restructure our tax system. That means a more equitable and more progressive tax system that asks those who actually benefited over the last decade from economic growth to pay their fair share. That means reversing some of or all of the Trump tax cuts. It also means giving the IRS the additional revenue, the resources it needs to actually enforce what's on the books so that the government gets the money it's supposed to get.
Yeah, I will say that if listeners go to our website, onpointradio.org, we did a whole hour about funding the IRS so that it can actually recoup revenue that is currently owed to the United States Treasury, but not paid by tax cheats. But Maya McGinnis, I know you wanted to respond as well, but go ahead.
Yeah, sure. Well, let me start by vehemently agreeing with Christian that we do need to increase the investments in our budget. And we do need to do them in a way that generates shared growth and prosperity. And also on the specifics of what you both were just talking about, this tax gap policy, this is a no-brainer. We have revenues that are not being collected that are owed. That is the first thing we should be doing, is making sure that anyone or any company that owes taxes is paying them, and closing the tax gap is really important. Where I disagree with Jack is when he talks about how much of this would be paid for. The Biden administration has done a great job of laying out their priorities and saying they want to pay for them. But the way the numbers are coming out, there'd be a tremendous amount of borrowing, which is unjustified given how strong the economy is. So if you look at the different policies, there's about $400 billion that would be borrowed for this bipartisan infrastructure bill. The reconciliation package is allowing $1.75 trillion in new borrowing. And if you extended the policies, which they are going to arbitrarily cut off to make the bill look smaller than it actually is, a trick that Republicans also did with tax cuts, it would add another $1.75 trillion. If you add interest, we're talking about borrowing over $4 trillion to pay for this, to finance this new agenda. That's too much borrowing for right now. And it's significantly more than we borrowed when we shouldn't have, for the Republican tax cuts. And the final point I would make is I'm a political independent. I don't look at this as we should be using fiscal policy in order to help one party or the other. That's the story both parties tell themselves. That's why we have reckless unpaid for tax cuts. That's why we're talking about and trying to justify huge borrowing for big investments instead of paying for them. And if it's a political football, it's going to hurt the country.
I'm really running down on time here, but can I just jump in here for a second? This is such a good conversation. I think one of the key things is the question of what is justified, right? Because the United States, I'm looking at a CNBC report here from a couple of years ago. The United States spent $6 trillion on the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. That wasn't for investment here in the United States, but that you know, obviously was it seemed politically justified at the time. So I wonder if this is not so much an economic question, but as you were saying, Maya, a political one. It's just that some administrations find it justified to expand the national defense to pay for wars and for tax cuts. Others find it justified to, you know, rural broadband and you know, what Christian Weller has been talking about.
Yeah.
I think economics is not the right lens.
It's a great point that actually fiscal responsibility means borrowing for economic reasons, not political reasons, because we have two parties that are trying to clobber each other right now, and it's doing damage to the long-term health of the country. But a really important discussion that you're talking about is how should we allocate our resources? And one thing we need to do is, in fact, is if you talk about paying for something instead of making it free by borrowing, it makes you think more about, is this something we should be doing? Does this have the support of the country? And then let's do it and let's figure out how to pay for it. Like Kristen said, let's repeal some of the tax cuts. We should be talking about carbon taxes. We should be talking about getting rid of tax breaks. We should be talking about caps on spending, which is growing much higher than the economy. There are a lot of options.
So, Christian Weller, I've got about a minute left, and I want to give you and Jack both a little time. I'm going to squeeze both of you in here, but go ahead.
So one of the things Maya said, like, right now is not the time to deficit spend because growth is good. Growth has been good, and thanks to the American Rescue Plan, but there is tons of uncertainty still out there. Short-term growth can quickly break off if the pandemic gains steam, as there's lots of uncertainty in the global economy. The other part is, we've had the same, we lived through the sort of same situation after the Great Recession, right? We had sort of quite fast growth in the first few quarters coming out of the Great Recession, and then we had middling growth that went along with massive income inequality that didn't address the problems that we have, the crumbling infrastructure, climate risks, and so on and so forth. We need to learn our lessons from the past decade, and now is the time to address them. That is, make the investments in faster productivity growth, in innovation, in rural broadband, in the healthcare infrastructure, in the childcare infrastructure, in an elder care infrastructure, especially in an aging society, and addressing climate risks. Those are all parts of Biden's proposal. They will translate. They will build on the current momentum of economic growth towards faster economic growth and more income inequality.
Yeah. Jack, I'm going to give you the last 15 seconds here. Your thought?
Well, I'm looking at a quote from Olivier Blanchard, the chief economist of the IMF, and he speaks of what he calls a shift in fiscal paradigm, that we have to think about deficits and debt and spending in a new lens set against the panorama, the disturbing panorama of climate change.
Well, Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst, it's a pleasure to have you always. Christian Weller, Senior Fellow at the Center for American Progress and Professor at the University of Massachusetts Boston, thank you as well. And Maya McGuinness, President of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, thank you. Terrific conversation with all of you. Much appreciated. And, I mean, this conversation is a crystal clear example about how, through different lenses, massive government spending can help big problems or emergencies like the COVID pandemic. But how have people weathered the past 15 months on an individual level? That's also something we've been thinking a lot about. So we've been checking in with guests who joined us last year, and Alyssa Epple is one of them. She's a professor in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of California, San Francisco, where she studies the effects of stress. And she joined us on the show back in March of 2020 to talk about resilience in the face of social isolation because of all the COVID shutdowns. And when we checked in with her again, Alyssa recalled her mindset in the early days of the pandemic.
We were still in acute adjustment stage, and we were still figuring out, what is this? So we had lots of different types of reactions. Some of us had panic buying. There were a lot of catastrophic thoughts about where this might go. And then there was a lot of rising up to the moment to say, today we can sing. The sound of the songs of people in Italy singing opera from their balcony is such a heartwarming memory of the human spirit in times of distress rising up for social solidarity. And then we had the stage of clanging pans. again, on our balconies or out our windows for healthcare providers. So there was all these beautiful moments of humans wanting to help others and have a voice. Could this be that this is going to leave us in a chapter with a stronger social fabric, with more social solidarity, with people actually caring for their neighbors? And it was such a hope, such an amazing thought that we would end up there. And I do think that we have edged there, but we're still in crisis. So we're still separated in many different cities and states. And we're now looking at the upswing of another wave. And so, you know, on one hand, we know what to do. And this is such old news. And boy, we've been through this before, of shutting down and testing and masking. And on the other hand, this is really devastating news to people whose income can't survive in another shutdown, and to youth. They've had the biggest hit to mental health of all of our age strata. The mental health data shows that it's our youth who have had the most depression and the dramatic increases in suicidal thoughts. And so it's with a lot of dread that I see this new wave coming to us. One of the hardest moments was when I realized that our son was creating a very, very negative view of people. And I'm such an optimist that it was a shock to me that he doesn't have hope for the climate crisis, that he thinks that there's, you know, more bad people than good. And then I realized that so much of what he's seeing and what we talk about at dinner is about the crises and about things that concern us. And so we have made a point to not watch the news. We still get high quality news. So I don't know how quickly or how much he will change his views of the world, but it really breaks my heart. I would say it's a daily conversation, and our views about human behavior and our future is depending in part what we pay attention to each day. So there is bad news that we could pay attention to, and there's also good news and good things that people do. And so really shifting our focus to be hopeful and to focus on all the good in the world. I find that when I get very distressed about the climate situation here, my whole outlook changes after talking with someone who knows more than I do about all of the great changes that are happening for climate in policy, in technology, actions of people in different countries. And these people are climate experts. And so I get my hope from true experts who have been in this field for decades. And they see, of course, the dreaded changes to climate, but they also see that the world is waking up to the changes we need, and that all over, great things are happening. And when we each do our bit together, it will make a difference. And I consciously decided to hold that positive view and work toward that.
Elissa Epple is a professor in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of California, San Francisco. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.